on the one hand, some people are sort of recognizing that the technology and the web and all the associated technology is a source of effectively monopoly and stymieing competition. And on the other hand, it's a source of continual innovation. And so how do you reconcile these two ideas in one's mind?
Hey guys, it's Trish from Montes. Don't miss great tech stories from our guests and our hosts, Jackie Nimenk and Wato Del Barre, only here at Mangtas Nation.
Welcome to Mangtas Nation Season 2. This season is all about tech of the future. We'll be sharing real-world experiences and featuring astounding guests to help guide you in your tech journey. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
I'm ready.
I'm ready.
I'm ready.
The show starts right now.
Hello, everyone. In today's episode of Mangtas Nation, we are very lucky to be joined by a stellar author, tech entrepreneur, and research leader. He's very interested in computational social science that deals with how data science is utilized to understand global economic, business, and social trends. He has written a new book, which we will delve onto later, that talks about how technology has rewritten the laws in economics and helps individuals and businesses prosper. Surely, we have a lot to learn today. Listeners, let us all welcome Professor Paul McCarthy. Hey, Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jackie. Thanks, Walter. Good to have you. Good to be here.
Also with my co-host, Wouter. Hey, Wouter. Also, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jackie.
Now, before anything else, Paul, let's start with a little bit about yourself, please.
Okay, thanks, Jackie. Yeah, so my background, as you said in the intro, I'm a research leader and author. So I work as an adjunct professor at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. In computer science, focusing on computational social science. So that's sort of the intersection of artificial intelligence, machine learning, and trying to solve social and economic sort of problems. I'm also a writer. I write for Forbes, and I write for, I've written the book, as you mentioned, Online Gravity, and I write a number of articles for different venues. I also work as a consultant to various businesses and governments, giving them advice on technology, artificial intelligence, machine learning, and how it can help them. And like you guys, I'm a tech entrepreneur, so I've got a business it's in talent analytics in the research space, and we help universities find talent, research talent around the world. We also work with some publishers in that space, so we work with Nature and News Corp, and we help produce analytics around the who's who in the research world.
You seem to have a lot that keeps you very busy, Paul, apart from teaching, and then you're also consulting with the government institutions, I believe. But so before we delve into that, you mentioned your book, of course, Online Gravity. And tell us a bit about your book and what pushed you to write your book. I see that, you know, it's, you know, a book that spans 20 years of all the research that you did. So tell us a bit more about that.
The book came about because I guess I had this series of observations working in technology. I started my career at IBM, and I worked at establishing their regional digital media center in Australia. And I guess I learned that people in the technology space understood things differently, and how technology, I guess, was transforming things, not just in the tech space itself, but beyond that into the broader economy. And I guess some of the lessons, so that's really what prompted me to write it, was just an observation that people in the tech sector had insights about the way in which the economy was evolving and was changing, basically. And there's some fundamental changes, I think, to economics that technology has brought about, in particular the digitization of the business world, but also connectivity through the web. And so I think the book outlines some of these key changes. One of the fundamental tenets that it's changed is the dynamics around competition and about what the rules of competition are.
And maybe a little bit of a follow-up on that, if I may. So can you give some examples of how the rules of competition changed as a consequence?
Sure. So in traditional economics, I guess, there is a handbrake on natural monopolies or oligopolies forming. And that is, it costs more to attract and retain customers. So if you look at businesses like soft drinks, for example, for 100 years there's been two companies dueling it out globally, Pepsi and Coke, and they're both significant enterprises and they both have significant market share. And despite their efforts and lots of smart people, they haven't been able to change that market share significantly over 100 years. You can look at that market share and it's almost a straight line. And if you look at most mature industries, the evolution of most industries is that there's kind of an innovation, often technology-led. So in automotive, about 100 years ago, there was a wellspring of new companies and competition, and you get typically hundreds of new companies in these new technology-enabled industries. And that winnows down, of course, but the end state with traditional economics is usually an oligopoly. So today in the automotive business, there's still around 10 players globally that are independent of one another and are still effectively competitive. But in the tech world, you see very different things happening. So, for example, in the search space, in the beginning of search online, you had similar to the advent of the car industry, you had a lot of players emerging. There was over 20 major search companies, as those of us old enough to remember that will remember. And Google was the 12th or 13th one, to come along. So they weren't the first, but certainly once they gained traction and reached a certain critical mass with users, due to a number of factors that I outline in the book, they gained an advantage over their competition. And then now they're dominant in most English language countries around the world. And the second player, and this is sort of this, the unofficial subtitle of the book, is that there's no Pepsi in cyberspace. There's no sort of dominant competitor, really. There's a lot of niche players, and there's certainly dominant players in other languages, in other territories, in China, in Russia, for example. But mostly in the English language world, Google's managed to dominate. Mm-hmm. And it's not just in search we see this, but we see it also in social. You've got clearly Facebook dominating in most territories.
Relationship management, Salesforce.
Exactly, you name it. The metaphor in the title of the book, Online Gravity, is the observation that in the online world, the way that business evolves in new categories is similar to the way in which our solar system evolved in its very early days. So it started with a lot of bits of rock and dust that were pretty evenly distributed, and then under the forces of gravity, they agglomerated around into the eight planets we're now familiar with. And the thing you notice about our solar system is that there's a lot of white space, as tech people would say, in between the planets. So mostly is not planets, but the planets are pretty clear, and there's either planets or moons, and it's a similar sort of scenario in the equilibrium end state, if you like, in the economy today, where most markets end in a dominant player and then niche players, rather than that sort of challenger. The challenger realm has been sort of eroded.
And why is that, in your opinion, Paul? Why is that different? Digitization and connectivity into the business world, well, why all of a sudden do we start having a gravitational pattern?
Yeah, Yeah, it's a good question, and as it's outlined in more detail in the book, but effectively it's a range of network effects, which means one of the key ones is this idea of increasing returns, so that it's beneficial to both the customers and to the companies to have more customers, not less. Whereas in traditional economics with physical distribution and customer loyalty, they provided friction and increased costs. So when Pepsi wants to steal share from Coke, it costs them lots of money, and it costs them increasingly more money to get customers that are loyal to the other brand, or that are in territories that they don't have distribution in, or and so on. So yeah, there's a number of network effects, and that includes also things such as familiarity of the users. Anyone who's worked in the enterprise software world understands that the stickiness of enterprise software, you know, and that basically it's welded to people's careers. And you know, in the enterprise accounting space, for example, SAP has done an incredible job at building an ecosystem which is basically the cadre of the world's top CFOs who are, you know, schooled and aligned with that ecosystem. And that creates a lot of inertia. It's a big moat. And we all know, even as personal users, you know, who wants to learn another word processing sort of system, even if it is sort of 20% better or 30% better or whatever. So I think, yeah,
No, go ahead, please. Let me interrupt you.
We had a paper published last year in a journal called PLOS One, where we looked at. So the book Online Gravity is kind of aimed at business readers and anybody really. It's an easy book to read, but last year we had a scientific paper published where we looked at the kind of formal theory of online gravity, if you like, and we looked at 10 years of social media data. So we looked at Twitter and Reddit, and we looked at the outbound links in both of those platforms, and we found two things. One is that over the long term, online diversity is in long-term decline. So that means online economic diversity we're talking about here. So we're saying that the number of links relative to the number of domains, they're resolving to less domains. So a small number of domains are commanding a larger share of the online attention as time goes on. Correct. So it's a measure of market power, as the competition lawyers say. The dominant companies are getting more and more dominant. The bad news, I mean, there is good news and bad news with all of this. So the good news is, I guess, that unlike traditional monopolies, these are what I call democratically elected monopolies. You know, like traditional monopolies are usually the result of deregulated natural, you know, government services like telecommunications or postal services, that sort of thing, or where there's a kind of a physical monopoly around an asset, you know, whether it's a dam or a toll road or something. But these are monopolies that people have voted for and that they love. We all love and benefit from these global businesses. And they have been very good to us. I mean, they're benign, largely. It's, I guess, the key lesson there, though, is if you want to be competitive and you want to compete directly with these companies, it's incredibly difficult. And we also showed in the same study that the so-called infant mortality rate of new websites, so in other words, that's representing new enterprises or new organizations, is shrinking over time. So more and more, the lifespan of new organizations is shrinking. It's getting harder and harder to compete. And here I like to use this sort of metaphor of pine trees. I think, you know, pine trees have these needles that they drop around them. So they kind of stymie all competition underneath the pine tree. And it means that if you're a plant trying to compete with that pine tree, there's not much chance you're going to be able to grow in its circumference. And in this paper that we had published, we worked with a colleague who's a evolutionary biologist, and so we learn a lot through his experience in the plant world about how this relates to the business world, because they're quite similar. And in fact, the measure that people use for competition, called the HHI index in economics, is the same equation that's used in biology. It's called Simpson's index, and it's a measure of diversity. So diversity or market power, that's the flip side of one another. So there's kind of a relationship between the natural world and the kind of business world. And the last finding, I guess, that I might mention, there's quite a lot in this paper, so anyone who's really interested should probably have a look. It's freely available online. The last significant finding was that functional diversity is on the increase. So as with the plant and animal kingdom, you have sort of structural diversity, you know, within it, and then you've got functional diversity. And we see, which is great, it was a great relief to us to try and understand and unpick, I guess, this problem, because on the one hand, some people are sort of recognizing that the technology and the web and all the associated technology is a source of effectively monopoly and stymieing competition. And on the other hand, it's a source of continual innovation. And so how do you reconcile these two ideas in one's mind? And the answer is it's both. And I think the thing is that a functional competition on functional basis is increasingly important as all markets become more and more global. Distinguishing on functional grounds is a much stronger basis for competition. And you can see it even in sort of social media in a simple sense. If you look at the social media sort of giants today, you know, there's a bunch of companies behind them, but there's also products. So there's sort of the first generation web stuff like Facebook. And then there's the kind of image-based mobile stuff, which they bought a couple of them, you know, Instagram and so on. Mm-hmm. And then you've got your sort of ephemeral video, which is, you know, dominated by Snap. And then you've got, you know, emerging TikTok. Short. Of course.
YouTube.
Of course. That's it. It's a good, and the interesting, they've all got their functional dominance. So they all own a niche, and they don't, and they, even though they replicate each other's features and they try and copy each other, you know, they end up still, that's one of the fascinating things. You know, you sort of think these planets, as I sort of describe them in the book, these massive, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of companies, now trillion-dollar companies, they, it's not as if they haven't tried to copy each other's, you know, it's not as if Facebook hasn't tried to do search. I mean, search, as we know, is the most successful and lucrative business on the planet. So a lot of people have tried to do it. And also people have tried to do it late into the picture. So there was a company called Cool, C-U-I-L, which was extremely well-backed, had a lot of clever people behind it. And they tried to do, and arguably they may have done search better than Google. Didn't matter, it's too late. And similarly, you know, there's plenty of people, there's attempts at Facebook to try and do search, there was attempts at Google famously to do social, and they were both, you know, unsuccessful. So I think there's kind of this inertia associated with these big ventures too.
Very interesting. So go ahead, Jackie.
Well, yeah, this is, I think, and also definitely in connection with what you talk about in your book, Paul, where the web operates via a set of rules that tend to favor certain outcomes. And these are, you know, the outcomes that have been favorable for these companies. And, you know, they seem to already understand the principles of online gravity, but have in, you know, in your experience, in your research, have you been able to narrow that down on what companies actually do to dominate their respective markets? Or is that top secret?
No, it's not really. No, I think I'm happy to share anything I understand. I mean, to the extent to which other people find it useful, that's great. I think to some extent there is a mixture of understanding and growing awareness as this has been happening. You know, I mean, there is a lot of awareness in the tech community, in the venture capital community, for example. And the fact that the venture capital community exists and runs the way it does, it by its very existence, they understand the nature that there's lots of failures and big successes. You know, it runs on a portfolio model whereby they get one Google and that pays for all the other losses, and they're willing to throw money at a range of crazy ideas. As long as you get one Google, then that's I mean, any other traditional investor, you know, traditional banker would look at what they're doing and say, this is just totally ridiculous. But they're working on this kind of idea that sometimes, and can they predict, can anyone predict, you know, who's going to be the next big thing, or can you even engineer it, you know, if you're at the helm of one of these things? Well, to some extent, I think there are sort of things that have been understood and known, but you'd have to say I think it's luck, timing, combination of things still. You know, even the best minds and the best venture capital companies, the returns are still, you know, very asymmetric. We're still getting these kind of distributions, even with the top VC firms. Andreessen Horowitz, for example, you know, you still find that companies, large number of companies don't go on, but, you know, they get their occasional. And you have to look at, for example, the some of the Y Combinator. If you look at the Y Combinator list, you know, there's over 1,000 companies who've been through the Y Combinator accelerator, the most celebrated accelerator on the planet. But there's about a dozen of them that account for the majority of the returns. That's out of 1,000 companies, you know. And they're the ones that everyone remembers, you know, Airbnb and so on. So
I just had a little bit of a follow-up question on you mentioned distinguishing on functional grounds, right? I guess that's your analogy to the planets, right? They have their own thing going on, space, and everything attracts to that planet. And you also mentioned a couple of things which are interesting here. You said, okay, we have these monopolies, but they've been good to us, and you mentioned the basically the network effect and the value of the network effect, which increases as it grows, right? Us as users actually benefit from it, right? And that's a fundamental principle that like a Pepsi or a Cola does not have.
Absolutely, hugely. Yeah, I think there are benefits. I think it's just been good to be mindful of the dynamics of the process, you know, and I think that there are certainly a lot of efficiencies and benefits in global enterprises, and I think it's just inevitable as the world becomes more global that we will have services and products that span, you know, multiple territories, and these types of economics will prevail. And I certainly think, you know, if they're run ethically, if the companies are run ethically, and they can provide an enormous amount of benefit for all of us as we all, you know, we all enjoy a lot of the benefits of those companies now. So yeah, I don't have any philosophical sort of disagreement with the idea of, I mean, we have to be mindful of some of the traditional behaviors of monopolist or dominant companies, you know, like price, you know, being the ability to manipulate prices, and I guess some of the regulators around the world are sort of grappling with some of these issues, because at the moment they haven't been necessarily all the same sorts of behaviors that traditional monopolists have had. But yeah, so I don't have a sort of a, I think they can be good.
Join us as we change the game of global outsourcing.
A platform for businesses to connect and collaborate.
A space specially designed for you. You can sign up as a vendor for free.
Only here at Mangtas.
Your curated marketplace for B2B outsourcing solutions. Join us now at www.mangtas.com.
Well, you have built an impressive career in data science, Paul, and you've even co-founded and led the League of Scholars. It sounds very Marvel-ish. So can you tell us about what you and your team do?
At League of Scholars, we analyze the world of research. So we use data science to understand at an individual level, you know, what people are doing, and understanding the productivity and impact of millions of scholars worldwide, and we look specifically at the talent of individuals. We do two things. One is we help institutions with recruitment. So that's our sort of main business, where we assist with the discovery and hiring of research talent, which is increasingly becoming cross-border and global. But we also work with a number of publishers to help identify lists of people and work on magazines. So we work with News Corp in Australia for a magazine that we produce each year. It's kind of like a who's who of research across 250 different fields, which profiles who's the current field leaders in all these areas across health, engineering, social sciences, law, across all research, as well as we work with Nature in London on occasional features around thematic features around the world. So we look at research trends about migration, talent migration, up-and-coming scholars in specific areas, emerging hot fields like material science and so on.
Very interesting stuff. And during COVID, what has been like one of the most interesting discoveries that your team has made?
I think one of the things we've noticed with COVID is obviously cross-border migration has stopped. You know, so we've got a lot of, we've had a lot of, you know, everyone's kind of, a lot of people have returned home to their, so here in Australia, for example, you know, we've had a lot of expats. Yeah, exactly. We've had about 20,000 Australians, I think, who've returned home from overseas, from Europe and America, Asia. And so there's been some sort of surprising sort of economic results as a result of that. I mean, no one would have predicted in Australia. We've had a global housing bubble. I think that's one of the really surprising outcomes. But also, I guess, there's been an increasing focus on particular types of research around, particularly around vaccines and around, you know, interest around health research. You know, it's gone. So there's increasing interest in those areas as well.
Okay, so it's pretty much research based on different aspects of or different fields that you guys tackle. I think.
We use a range of measures of individual researcher success. So traditionally, researcher success is measured by the number of publications that are published, peer-reviewed papers, or in the case of arts, humanities, and social sciences, often sometimes it's books or it can be conference papers, and then their impact, which means how many times they were cited by other authors. And you can use data science and machine learning to use these features and as well a whole range of other features to predict future likely success, as well as understanding, you know, who's leading in individual specific fields and subfields.
Now, despite the exponential growth of the online world, are some aspects of it slowing down? Do you notice? Or is just all a roller coaster ride?
Yeah, I think there seems to be a lot of acceleration generally. I mean, one of the most fascinating things I found in our own research was where we look at computational social science. We did a review of the top 10 papers in the last decade in computational social science, which is the kind of, it's the intersection of economics, psychology, history, as well as computer science, and using large-scale data sets to provide new insights into these areas. And one of the really interesting things was a look at all the books that have been published over the last 100 years. There's a project known as In Google Books, and then within that there was another related project called the Engram Viewer, where they looked at the frequency of various phrases that occur in those books each year. And many people have probably looked at this. If you haven't, it's fascinating. You can go online and you can do effectively a historic Google search, and you can see what the frequency of various topics or concepts have been in books over the last century, or it's actually over the last four centuries. And what the researchers that built this found, that some interesting trends. One was that the interest in any given year increases in books in the lead up to that year. So the number of times 1950 is mentioned increases in 1946, 1947, 1948, books in 1950, and so on. And then people get really excited in 1950, lots of books are published, and then 1951, people start forgetting, and so on. And so you get this kind of forgetting curve. But the interesting thing is the forgetting curve, if you look at all of these across the century, the forgetting curve is getting shorter, basically, and that we're forgetting things faster. And these sort of society-wide observations over long periods of time are the things that really interest me, because I think it's something we've never been able to see before at such a scale. Yeah.
Well, the forgetting curve, well, understandably, in my defense, I'm pregnant, so I'm quite forgetful. But what do you think is the reason for this, Paul?
That's a good question. I presume it's to do with the fact that there's an increasing
short
amount of
attention spans, or
that could be part of it, but it could also be that we have a finite capacity we do have a finite amount of attention, and there's an increasing amount of things to kind of pay attention to.
Yeah,
we've got basically unlimited information now at our fingertips, which can be a bit overwhelming for some people. And how to manage that is becoming an increasingly important thing, whereas, previously you probably didn't have to worry about that. But, I mean, it's also a really big opportunity, I think. A friend of mine's just written a book, which is going to be published later this year in the US and around the world. It's called Thriving on Overload by Ross Dawson. And he's interviewed people all around the world, and he's looked at these kind of what are the habits of people that are very effective at managing information themselves. What are their personal habits? How do we kind of get on top of all this kind of overwhelming amount of information?
And filter the information that you would like to absorb, and then filter the information that you don't want really to remember.
That's it. Exactly. Yeah. So I think we all need, I think that one of the key things we need to think is not to worry too much about these things, because I think, most information is not that important, on the flip side, there's the opportunity to find out things that we've never known before.
Yeah, there's always something new going on, some opportunity. And as you mentioned earlier, this information is at our fingertips. So if you want to learn something, the advantage is that you can just have easy access to it. You just have to have great Googling skills.
That's true.
Now, as we know, Paul, data science deals with massive, noisy, and unstructured data systems. But what do you think are some of the challenges or opportunities that data-driven companies have today?
I think one of the biggest opportunities is really tapping into latent knowledge. And that's this idea, I guess, that there's probably information within your company, particularly if you're a large organization, which you're not aware of, that could be extremely valuable to your own people and your own insight, increasing your own insights. And I think, this is one of the things, one of the research questions that interests me too, is not necessarily creating new information, but drawing insights in new ways from
existing
knowledge that's already there. There's a fascinating paper in Nature that was published a couple of years ago looking at the latent information in material science chemistry papers. And what they did was they used some of the techniques that we're using, so machine learning and a technique known as word embedding, to analyze historical scientific papers that were published in chemistry year by year. And what they showed is that using artificial intelligence, they could predict novel materials that were not yet known at various points historically. So you can use this kind of historic data to try and illustrate the potential for AI to discover information which is already in a corpus of data, but not that visible to those. And our research is doing similar things. We're looking at large-scale data sets across a range of fields, history, psychology, economics, and trying to understand these sort of big trends and key patterns that are there, but not that obvious.
Okay. Interesting. Now, Paul, you mentioned earlier at the very, very start of this show that you also work together with the government.
Yes.
How much change do you think are you affecting by working together with the government?
I think in Australia, at the moment in particular, the governments, we're very fortunate with our governments, both state and federal. We've got very, very good governance. I can't say that we've always had that, but I think at the moment we've been very good. Yeah. We've been, you know, like a lot of places, we've been having a lot of challenges with the environment. So, for example, earlier this year we had some really challenging floods in New South Wales. That's north of Sydney, and in Sydney itself, where, you know, thousands of homes were flooded, and you know, there were a number of people that died, and there's been a lot of people that are not able to go back to their home, and it's just been rather chaotic. And there's been an inquiry.
It was all over the news here as well in Belgium.
Was it? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So we've been. There's been an inquiry. The Premier commissioned an independent inquiry, and there's been a range of public submissions, and we've been commissioned to help with the inquiry to do text analytics of the submissions, so to help the commissioners understand the kind of key themes, you know, without bias, but just using machine learning to surface what are the key topics that are being mentioned in all the submissions. There's over, you know, over 1,500 submissions to this inquiry. But in addition to that, we also looked at search data and social data. So we looked at Twitter, and we looked at Google search data. And this Google search data in particular was really interesting. We found that we found about 300 terms that correlated to the floods. So a whole variety of different terms, and some of them were correlated, but were leading or lagging indicators of the floods. So in other words, you could unpack the pattern of behaviours of people, en masse in the lead up to the floods. People were looking for, you know, making preparations, looking for weather forecasts, and then during the floods, they're, you know, or during the lead up, they're looking for sandbags, and they're looking to, you know. And then during the floods, there's a whole range of things around rescue and, you know, emergency disaster recovery, all those sort of issues. And then after the floods, there's a range of, you know, cleanup issues. And then you get sort of, you can see in the search data aftershocks. So 7 days later, people are looking at, searching for landslides or for mudslides and other things. And then later issues around insurance come up. And so it's really, I think, useful. We've provided this analysis to the government or the independent inquiry that's been commissioned by the government, and it means that there'll be better planning. Hopefully, it'll inform better planning for future,
actually make informed decisions.
Exactly. Yeah.
And did they Did you feel as if all the research that you did and the data that you gave them, they actually took that into consideration, worked on it?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely, Jacqueline. Okay. Yeah, they've been really appreciative. The government's yet to respond to the report's yet to be published, but the government's, I think, going to be presented with the final report at the end of the month, and then they'll in turn decide what they're going to do, and there'll be a range of actions, I'm sure.
Fantastic. And, more and more governments should do this, in my opinion, get data from experts and from research and actually base their decisions on that. I mean, it's probably very normal for Australia to do that, but for, a lot of other countries, it's just more politics than, data-driven.
Absolutely, yeah. And I guess the thing is that the tools help, we can help governments surface these things from submissions. I mean, one of the challenges of government is you get a lot of feedback from the public, but it's quite hard to manage that. I mean, if you get 7,000 kind of, submissions in different forms, emails and documents, it's just
submissions, quite challenging. Suggestions, complaints, and
exactly, it's hard to understand, let alone that. So we can help governments with submissions analytics. This new field of submissions analytics is one of the things we're doing.
Amazing. You're doing so much amazing and fantastic work, Paul. And what do you do for yourself? I mean, for fun.
Oh, yeah, what do I do for fun? Tennis. Yes.
So you must be, have you been to like these pro matches in Australia?
Oh, that's a good question. No, but we've been watching, I've been watching the recent Wimbledon. Yeah, I don't know. Do you watch the tennis? I don't know. Did you watch it? I watched the...
Yeah, we do see here, but I don't deliberately watch it. I'm more of a football person.
Okay. What code of football do you like?
European football. So
soccer, yeah. We call it soccer in Australia.
Soccer. Oh, you call it soccer in Australia too? I thought it was only in America they called it soccer.
Yeah, it's just because in Australia football is a very confusing word because we have Australian Football League, AFL.
Yeah, it's just also league. Quite big there, no?
Rugby league's big in New South Wales. There's rugby union, and then there's the soccer, as we call it, which is I know they call it football in Europe. Yeah, oh, good. All right. So yeah, before you call it that, oh, good.
So did you or did you not go and see a professional Wimbledon match yet or not yet?
No, I wasn't able to. No, not. I watched. I did watch the game between Djokovic and Kyrgios in the recent Wimbledon finals. And I'm not a big fan of Kyrgios as you know his behaviours leave something to. But he is an unbelievable player. You realize just watching him, he's such an incredible player. It was a good match.
I can imagine. And one of the pro Belgian players, Kim Claesters, she's living in Australia. Now I don't know you also follow women's tennis, but yeah, she thinks she ended up marrying an Aussie, and so.
Oh, good.
She's there now, Kim.
Okay.
Well, Paul. I believe we're running a bit short on time, but thank you so much for being a guest on today's show of Mangtas Nation. Now, for businesses or organizations that would like to get in touch with you, how can they best contact you or reach you, or where can they best find you?
Simplest thing, Jack, is just to go to the website onlinegravity.com. You can also email me paul@onlinegravity.com.
Fantastic. We'll also make sure to put that on the show notes of this episode of Mangtas Nation. Well, Paul, thank you again. We've definitely learned a lot from this session with you. And we wish you a lot of success and see you soon.
Thanks, Jackie.
Thank you, Paul. Bye.
Bye now.
Thank you for tuning in to Mangtas Nation. Mangtas, your curated marketplace for B2B outsourcing solutions. Follow our social media pages to know more about us. Sign up as a client or sign up as a vendor and be part of this global B2B marketplace. Join us at www.mangtas.com.